ladies and gentlemen, the management of the Dunes Motel proudly presents America's most unpredictable comedian, Mr. Tubby Boo!
This is episode 21. How are things in Somerville, Nate?
Things in Somerville are fantastic. They're looking better now that you got the number of the episode right. And life is good. It's good to be back home.
Good to be back home as well. I spent the last week, I was visiting my grandmother in Florida, which is like 80% vacation and 20% work, because I'm kind of like her chauffeur when I'm down there. I don't think she's really accepted that I'm 30 years old. Like, I think I'm still in my early teens in her eyes. So, you know, she's trying to give me money. She's asking if I need clothes. She's telling me how to drive. Well, she's notorious for being annoying to drive with anyway, but there's some measure of work involved. It's not a pure vacation in Florida, but it is good to see her, but it is good to be home.
I don't imagine you went to any spring training baseball games, which is what I would have been doing in Florida that week.
No, I'm really just not that much of a baseball fan, not to mention she is keeping me busy, although I did. I usually see about two movies in the movie theater every year, and both of them are when I'm in Florida with my grandmother. So I saw Side Effects, which was one of the worst movies I've ever seen, although eventually it became so... The plot got so convoluted and the movie's so bad that it was kind of amusing just at how, like, ridiculous it was. But then the other one I saw was The Identity Thief, which I enjoyed a lot.
Yeah, I remember thinking that about The Avengers, that it was just so impossibly bad that it is just, you know, some kind of farce. But better to have one good movie and one comically terrible movie than two merely bad movies,
yeah,
right?
That's true. The other thing that I got to do in Florida, and we can come back to talk a bit more about this before we get into the interview, but today's interview is going to be, I would say, quite a bit different from previous ones that we've had on the show. I sat down, and unfortunately we had some technical difficulties. I was hoping to have Nate on the line as well while we were doing this, but I ended up doing a one-on-one interview with my grandmother about her brother, who was a 400-pound cross-dressing stand-up comedian. Even stand-up comedian kind of understates the breadth of his show. It was kind of a vaudeville type of act that he did, but he was real popular.
So, one-man show, if there ever was a one-man show.
Yeah. More like a man and a half, maybe. So we'll talk some about him. And he, in addition to being a pretty entertaining character in his own right, he definitely loved gambling, spent a lot of time at the tracks. And it's one of my, I don't know if it's fair to call it a regret, but it's an unfortunate thing, because I know, I mean, he died well before I was in my early teens when he died. So it was well before I had gotten into poker. But I know that he would have been extremely excited. It would have been a lot of fun to go to Las Vegas with him. I mean, he performed at a lot of the Las Vegas hotels in like the 1960s, 1970s, and it would have been a lot of fun to go to Las Vegas with him, and I know that he would have really enjoyed the World Series of Poker and seeing me play in the World Series of Poker and that sort of thing. So I'm going to talk some about my grandmother, and hopefully you'll find this person to be as interesting as I do.
Yeah, I've listened to the interview. It's fantastic. I also enjoyed every minute of it. So hopefully you guys do too. And if not, the timestamps are in the show notes, and just speed right through it, and we'll see you next week.
I will say, though, I think the best parts of the interview are at the end. I don't want to give away too much, but I think if you're kind of on the fence while you're listening to it, I would encourage you to stick it out, because I do think that it closes strong. If you're just finding it incredibly boring, then yeah, go ahead and skip it.
I mean, one of my great fascinations as a poker player is just what Las Vegas used to be like. I mean, I'm a child, poker child of the poker boom, right? I mean, even if I got started a year before Chris Moneymaker won the World Series, by the time I was out in Las Vegas, especially with any regularity, Harrah's owned pretty much the whole strip, and I've really never spent much time at any place that wasn't a strip casino or Binion's or a Chinese restaurant, right? And all these old stories about Las Vegas and the biggest game in town by Al Alvarez, and even like the movie Casino. I mean, all these things have just made me so curious about what Las Vegas used to be like and how different it was. So yeah,
it's hard to imagine a pre-corporate Las Vegas.
And like a pre-sanitized Las Vegas. I mean, you can still get yourself into plenty of trouble, but I definitely think I'm in some kind of theme park most of the time that I'm there.
Right. Yeah, it's not the same Wild West place it used to be.
I mean, I have eaten a $6 off menu steak. That gives me some kind of cred, but nothing like the way it really used to be, I'm sure. I am, after all, only 29 years, 364 days old. So
it's you're a young man until tomorrow.
That's right. That's right. I'll do something real wild tonight.
So, like record a podcast. Tell my baby that I'm all alone. By the time I count one to four, I hear her on my door. Set in the evening when the sun goes down, when there ain't nobody else around. She kisses me and holds me tight. Tell me, fat boy, everything's all right. That's why I know.
We thought we might start book club, a thinking poker book club. The book for the book club in March will be Playing the Player by Ed Miller. We're going to read a few chapters of it every week. We're going to talk about it on the air. If you want to read it and send us questions, send us comments, send us anything about the book, we'll be quite likely to read many listener comments on the air. That'll be something to look forward to next week. If you're interested in reading along, please do. And if not, we hope you'll enjoy the discussions anyway.
Yeah, so the way this is going to work, we will, over the course of the month of March, we'll be reading this book. We'll talk about different sections of it each week. So for our next podcast episode, which is going to be released on March 6th, for that episode, we are going to be talking about the introduction and part one of the book, which has to do with playing against tight players. So if you want to get the most out of this opportunity, the thing to do is go buy Ed Miller's book, Playing the Player. I would encourage you to buy it directly from Ed's website, which is notedpokerauthority.com. And he's got links up there where you can buy the book directly from him. You can get an ebook, or you can get a paperback, or you can get a discount if you buy both. I'll have a link for that up in the show notes as well. So I encourage you to go buy the book from Ed or pick it up from somewhere. Maybe you already have it. Read those first two sections, the introduction and part one, before you listen to the March 6th edition of the podcast. And then on March 6th, Nate and I will be on here talking about that portion of the book. And then we'll be doing part two for the March 13th episode and so forth. And then we hope to get Ed in here on the show to talk about the book as well. That'll most likely be for the last week in March. Probably we're going to get Ed on the show, and he can talk about, you'll be able to get his take on the book. And as Nate said, we want to encourage you to write in with your questions. I mean, we'll give our thoughts on sections of the book, but this is your opportunity to ask questions about things that confuse you or things that the book prompts you to think about. And, you know, again, you'll get Nate and my take on it immediately, and then depending on how many questions we get, we'll try to pass as many of them as we can on to Ed as well, and you can hear from the author what he thinks about it. She kisses me and holds me tight. Tell me, fat boy, everything's all right. That's why I know.
So we have a hand this week. and it comes from the one and only Gareth Chandler. This hand is in Uruguay. It's 3-6 American dollar, no limit hold'em. It's 5% rake, uncapped, which brings me to my first comment, which is, if this isn't the best game you've ever seen, do not play in a 5% uncapped, no limit game. And that's just simple arithmetic. It's just, you don't want to do it. Do the math. You're riding a much thinner edge than you think you are. If you have five people who are stacking off with any pair any time, that's one thing. If you're always going to put the money in good when any big bet goes in, that's one thing. But if you're at all in doubt, just stay home and play on PokerStars, Gareth. And Gareth says, cutoff and hijack. So the cutoff is the main villain in this hand. Cutoff and hijack are both my age and seem to be grinders. This is my first session at the casino, so you don't know the game is good, do you? And I am up about $160 after a small losing start. Hijack has played very well and seems very relaxed at the table, thoughtful, etc. Cutoff is less observant and has played fewer pots. Had I to guess, Hijack is a winning player in the game, but Cutoff is probably a break-even tag. Cutoff has done a few things already. First, I saw him 3-bet from the small blind huge with kings. There was a substantial preflop raise of 35 in front of him with a call, and he made it 135. After that, I saw under the gun limp and early position isolation to $18. Really weak, would always be bigger with value. Then someone called in middle position, and he... this is the main villain, the cutoff, made it $45 on the button. He ended up seeing the flop three ways, and on Jack 5-4, faced a donk bet of 80, and didn't hesitate to fold, and didn't seem like he even minded, almost resigned to losing the pot. Onto the hand.
But before we get into the hand, let's talk about what does that information tell us about the cutoff? What are we going to conclude about him, just based on those reads that Gareth has given us so far?
I mean, easily the most important thing I'm taking away from this is that the cutoff's raise size should be dependent on the strength of his hand, and in particular that he's looking to protect his stronger hands with bigger raises. That's something that people don't mix up too much. Somebody who's inclined to do this is actually quite likely to do it again the second time. Mm-hmm. So it's not like many other things that you'll see at the table where just because somebody does something once, like slow playing a set, that doesn't mean they're going to do it the next time. But over raising with a hand like queens or kings, that's often a very reliable trade.
Yeah, and it's incredibly easy to spot, and it's incredibly easy to take advantage of. Yes. Which, I mean, the most obvious way is to take advantage of, and both of these are hugely profitable things to do. This is why we wanted to emphasize the importance of this read. The one kind of obvious thing is that generally you're going to be folding when this player makes a huge raise, but that's actually saving you quite a bit of money if you had a hand that you would have otherwise called and played a pot with. And you're able to fold knowing that the player has a very strong hand, then you're saving a good deal of money there. So that's quite profitable. And then the other thing is that you should be inclined to attack the smaller raises that player makes. Essentially what that person is saying is, I don't have the nuts. I don't have a hand particularly close to the nuts. I don't have a hand that I feel excited about. And often three betting that player will enable you to take the pot immediately or after the flop. Sometimes you'll see the same tell, for example, with continuation bet sizing or with post-flop bet sizing. And again, you can devise a plan to attack players who, when they make smaller bets, whether you're going to do it by floating or by bluff raising. I just think if you attack small bets and fold the large bets from these types of players, it's a pretty simple self-evident strategy, but a very profitable and easy to implement one.
I think that's exactly right. And in fact, in the hand, the hijack, who is the good player, not the main villain, opens for 20. And Gareth couldn't remember the last pot that came to the hijacked unopened, and that was a small opener for the hijack. Cut off, the main villain, 3-bet to 55. And Gareth had 8-3 suited on the button, and he hadn't been active or nitty. He'd showed down two hands, both value hands, both winners. Anyway, he made it 125. And I think we both like the choice to put in a 4-bet here. Just because the small 3-bet means probably that he doesn't have a very good hand, or maybe that he has aces, but whatever, Gareth has a blocker to that hand. Mm-hmm. So I like the 4-bet. I think I probably would have made it a bit more, just to give a better chance if he's light to fold right away. Obviously, there are some reasons why you want even to continue to the flop if he's likely to check fold on the flop, but I would be shooting a little bit more to get an immediate fold. So I would probably have made it closer to 150 before the flop. If I had to pick a number, I would say 145. What do you think of that?
I would say that there's, and I don't think Gareth really has the read to make this distinction, although maybe he does. But generally, I mean, I try to think about what kind of player I'm up against and how I'm going to make him fold. I think there are two ways of making a guy fold a weak hand. One is trying to get him to make a disciplined fold, which is relying on him doing some hand reading. And that's a case where you can get away with using smaller bets because the player is going to, like, the more that you see people trying to make reads and act on their reads, the more you can get away with risking less money on this kind of bluff, where you can rely on the player potentially folding a hand like ace queen pre-flop or check folding. If maybe he calls you with a suited connector and he flops top pair, he may check fold it if he doesn't have any kind of draw. If he's going to be really disciplined in making a read and saying, well, this guy wouldn't four bet without a big pair, therefore I need to check fold top pair, I need to let go of my ace queen pre-flop. If you believe you're up against a player who's capable of that kind of hand reading and has that kind of discipline to fold a seemingly strong hand for a not particularly large amount of money just because he's confident in his reads, I think you can get away with the smaller raise size that Gareth made. The other strategy is the hammer, which is, you know, a guy is weak and you just kind of pound him over the head with the fact that you have a better hand than he does. And in this case, you're not relying on the guy doing as much hand reading, or at least not much sophisticated hand reading. Basically, you're just relying on the guy saying, damn, this kid's willing to put a lot of money into the pot. He must have a good hand. And it's not really going any further than that. It's not about, oh, he must be on an extremely tight range to cold four bet me. You're not necessarily trying to make these players fold really great hands, or at least you can't afford to give them as good of a price if you expect them to fold hands like ace queen preflop or a top pair, even any kind of flopped pair. So against the player who's doing less hand reading, I think that a larger bet size is more important.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think that just, I meant to say what I was doing as like just an empirical claim about what I would do if I were in that spot. Mm-hmm. And generally, and this is actually a leak in my game, I generally save my fancy stuff for players who I'm not counting on doing a lot of hand reading. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but when I'm four betting light, it's usually just because I think I can hit him over the head with a hammer, to use your metaphor. And so I would be in the hammer scenario, and so I would make it bigger.
Yeah, I think this is an appropriate hammer spot.
Yeah.
Like, basically, I'm going to assume that the hammer is the way to go when I'm dealing with a random live player until he shows me otherwise. And if he's varying his raise size based on the strength of his hand, he probably needs some hammering.
Yeah, then if he shows you otherwise, then that's when you get out the scalpel, right?
So. Yeah.
Okay, so the hijack snap folds and the cutoff snap calls. And he calls as if he has no choice, which I think is a really nice, I'm not sure I'll be making a whole lot out of it this hand, but I think that's the sort of thing that you, that sort of comment indicates a good live player to me. That's the sort of thing that is true to the psychology of live poker, true to the psychology of your weaker opponents, and big kudos to Gareth for noticing that and putting it in that way.
Yeah.
So the flop is 8-7-2, all clubs. Gareth's hand is not clubs, he's suited in spades. So 8-7-2, monotone, not Gareth's suit. So the pot is 275, and the stacks are about 600 behind on the flop, and the cutoff checks. And Gareth bets 110 into 275. What do you think of that?
This is a spot where I do like the smaller bet sizing. Okay. I think this is it's not a flop that's especially likely to have hit the villain, especially if we feel like he has this, well, I was priced in, I have to call preflop. I think on a flop like this, his calling range is going to be relatively insensitive to the size of your bet, where he, you know, preflop, I would say he most likely has one of three types of hands, which is going to be either pocket pairs, Broadway cards, or some kind of suited connector type thing. The Broadway cards are probably the least likely out of that category. I mean, those are going to be the least good against if he does perceive the four betting range to be strong, I think he's least likely to feel priced in with those kinds of hands because they really don't flop well against a strong range. And I think those are also the hands that are most likely to be bet size sensitive, because whether or not he continues if he has a hand like king queen with one club may well depend on the size of your bet. But with any other type of hand, like, I think if he has a pocket pair, he's either going to fold it or not, and I don't think it matters too much whether you bet 110 or 160. And if he has over cards without a club, I think he's definitely folding them. If he has suited connectors, obviously he's not folding a flush, but if he whiffed I suppose there's some question if he has like 10-9 of hearts or 9-8 of hearts. I mean, I think 9-8 of hearts is probably calling. 10-9 of hearts might be sensitive to the size of your bet. Overall, though, I still think you want to give yourself room to bet future streets. You can usually get away with smaller bet sizes in a 4-bet pot because you're somewhat effectively leveraging his stack. I mean, even with a small bet, you can easily get stacks in by the river. So I feel like there's a lot less impetus to be trying to build a big pot if you actually had a big hand. I think a small bet is perfectly consistent with Hero having a big hand. That's maybe one of the best arguments for it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I'm less inclined to discount Broadway cards than you are, just because when you make it only $70 more, I can easily see somebody can't fold king queen or a hand like that. And I also think he's a bit less likely to have suited connectors in the first place. I'm also inclined to think that even though in fact a small bet is perfectly consistent with a very strong hand, I'm not sure I would trust him to think that way. And I think the small bet might be perceived as weak. Honestly, I don't really know what to do in this situation. For the same reasons I would have brought out the hammer preflop, I would bet more on this flop if I was going to bet. But that's mostly because I think there's a pretty good chance he could have whiffed over cards or even fold a hand like pocket fours or just give me enough information to make me confident that he can fold whatever hand he has later. So I think I would have bet more or nothing, but I am not really good at this kind of spot, so I probably defer to you here. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the question of how many, what is your plan if he calls? I mean, there's potentially room here. If you're making small bets, if you're making bets that are in the neighborhood of 30 to 40% of pot, you can do that 3 times. Or maybe you'd have to be on the low end of that, but you can bet something like 30% of pot 3 times. And if you bet larger than that, you're not going to be able to triple barrel. If you're betting 50 or 60% of pot, then a bet on the flop, like any turn bet you make, is going to be functionally all in, or you're not going to be able to make a turn bet and still have money behind to make a meaningful shove on the river.
Yeah.
So I think if you're thinking that you may end up going for 3 barrels here, if villain just check calls twice and that you may want to barrel some rivers, I also think that is going to require making a smaller size.
That makes sense. Again, I'm starting to see how some of the parts of my strategy fit together because I rarely 4-bet light and then 3-barrel after that. And usually when I'm bluffing against players, it's with fewer larger bets. So maybe that's not the best strategy to have, but all the things you've just told me are all the reasons you've just told me not to bet bigger because it'll take certain plays out of my arsenal are definitely not plays that are a big part of my arsenal to begin with. So I'm suboptimal, but in a sort of consistent way. Anyway, so Gareth bet 110 and the cutoff called. Going into the turn, the pot was $495. And it was the 9 of diamonds. So it was 8-7-2 all clubs. Turn was the 9 of diamonds, 495. So the cutoff checked, making eye contact, which I would interpret as meaning he has a little something but doesn't want to face a bet. Gareth bet 165, and the cutoff called unhappily. What do you think of that bet? So is this more of this 30 all the way down business?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm not even sure if I love the turn barrel. I mean, I think if I'm going to bet the turn, I don't really see a need to make it big, but I don't know that this is the best turn card to bet. If we think about what villain's flop calling range likely is, I don't see him folding too many pocket pairs here. The only exception would be if we think he peeled the flop with threes through, even sixes has an open-ended straight draw, though. It's really just like threes, fours, and fives. I don't think he's folding a set. I don't think he's folding over pairs. I wouldn't be real likely to think he's going to fold an over pair for one third of the pot anyway.
I mean, I doubt he has an over pair, but I agree that he's unlikely to fold it. I mean, just because of the pre-flop read, he doesn't have too many over pairs.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, I don't think we're getting him to fold like anything from that pocket pair category. Anything that he called the flop with that was from that suited connector category is pretty unlikely to fold now. I mean, he probably has a pair plus a draw or two pair or something that he's not going to be letting go of. And so, I mean, that really just leaves the overcards that might have peeled the flop because they had a flush draw. there's the potential to make them fold. Hero is actually ahead of some of those. Not that, I mean, that's not by itself a reason not to bet, but it does reduce the value of bluffing. If villain is peeling here with, say, king, queen, or king, jack with one club, and if those hands did call the flop, I don't know that they're folding the turn for a bet of a similar percentage. I would probably look to check here and bluff non-club rivers.
Yeah, that would be my default. That would be my default. I also think that the cutoff might have peeled even with sometimes with overcards that don't have a club in them. It sounds like an atrocious play, and it is, but I think that it's definitely a possibility, and I've seen it more than once. And just because, I mean, only because there are so many combinations that will get to the flop, I think, of overcards with no club, I think we have to be sensitive to the fact that even a 10 or 20% chance that he calls with them makes sense to his overall range. So,
I think the bet check bet line is pretty effective against those hands as well. Like, those hands are going to miss quite often on the river, even more often. I mean, I guess the downside of that, if you don't bluff club rivers, is that sometimes he'll win the pot with like ace queen or ace king no club. But other than that, I mean, I think he's if he does have king queen with one club, he's not going to be able to call the river all that often. So
yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Oh, I mean, you beat king queen, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, because if he has ace queen no club or ace queen with one club, he's not going to be able to call the river very often.
Yeah, I find myself leaning toward bet check bet. Anyway, so Gareth bet 165, cutoff called. It's a tricky spot. I incline toward a check. Gareth says sometimes players fake unhappiness to induce where weak is strong. This player was unhappy but was not showing it. I don't have a great way to describe it, but his frowns and furrows were not pronounced. But he wasn't pleased or comfy. It's a subtle difference, but one I think you two will understand. Yes, we do understand. It's an important difference. And in this kind of situation, I mean, of course, I wasn't there and you're describing it to me. But even before considering that paragraph, I would be much more inclined to interpret body language Gareth was describing as weak or medium strong, but more likely medium week to week. The river is the jack of clubs, so that brings the fourth club, 8-7-2-9 jack, four clubs, 825 in the pot, and the effective stacks are 340. Cutoff checks quickly. Gareth takes 30 seconds and he moves all in for the 340 effective, and that's the play. I went back and forth on this. At first, I didn't like it. Then eventually, I came around to the view where I think it's kind of mandatory.
Yeah, mandatory is exactly the word I was going to use. I mean, you're getting such a good price on your bluff at this point, and it's probably going to look a lot stronger than that. I mean, he's risking less than half the pot. Not a lot less, but he's risking less than half the pot to bluff at it. And I know we talked about this on the show before. These bets that are large in absolute terms, I mean, it's half of a stack, it's $340. Even though it's only half the pot, I think live players, and probably a little more so this young grinder sort. I mean, a guy in a 3-6 game, and it seems like a lot of the people Gareth is playing against, in at least when he was playing in Colombia and in Peru, he was playing against a lot of kind of wealthy people who had money to throw around. If this guy is a young, like possibly a professional poker player, he's probably not bankrolled for this game. I think it's actually extremely unlikely that he's adequately bankrolled to be playing 3-6. Doesn't mean it's a mistake for him to be playing it, but I do think that the absolute amount of money is going to be threatening to him. I think there's not a lot of like younger professional, like exclusively live players who are properly bankrolled to be playing for stakes like this when they're playing it. It's much more likely, I think, that he's taking a shot or that he's playing relatively underrolled. So I think you've got that going for you. The fact that it's all in looks strong. The fact that it's the third bet looks strong. There's a ton of stuff that contributes to this being a scary bet to villain that doesn't cost Hero any money. I think that's all an argument for betting.
Yeah, and especially a lot of these players, even some of the better ones, have absolutely no idea how much money is in the pot. And there's a good chance that the other person is estimating the pot at like 500 or something like that. So, no, I think that's good. I mean, also, if he calls and wins, the house is going to take $75 right off the top. So, I mean, does he really even care that much? I don't know. So, sorry, I'm still ragging on Gareth for even sitting in this game. But
I mean, is this villain going to hero call here with like 9-8 no club? My experience anyway, if anything, the live player type, particularly given all the other factors that I already mentioned about this being a potentially scary spot for him, is going to overestimate the likelihood of hero having hit the club and not correctly read hero for being polarized when he shoves this river. Like, the guy may well be saying to himself, oh, all he has to do is have any club. And I mean, if villain is holding, let's say, 9-8 or even a set, you know, this kid just needs one club and I'm beat. He's not necessarily thinking, like, what are the clubs that Gareth would actually shove for value? Maybe he would only actually shove the ace and the king, and how frequently we get here with a bluff. He could actually be bluffing pretty frequently. I think a lot of people are just inclined to think in terms of, all it takes is one club and I'm beat, so I have to fold.
Yeah. And Gareth can represent the ace of clubs so easily. I mean, I wouldn't make this bet planning to fold out the queen of clubs, but I could even see a lot of people fitting this description having king-queen with the queen of clubs and thinking that Gareth is just so convincingly represent either ace-king with a club, aces with a club, or kings with a club that he just can't call.
That one I'm going to have to disagree with. The main reason is just that villain just hit the card he was looking for if he was calling flop and turn. So even if it would be like a correct fold, I think you're not going to see people real inclined to let go of those kinds of hands at this point. Like if he called the flop and the turn with king queen one club, I can't imagine he's going to fold a club river.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Sorry, I was sort of living in my fantasy world where I did what I would have done and not bet the turn, but especially after betting and betting. No, that was a brief mistake. The way I play, I usually don't give people a lot of credit for folding medium hands in this kind of situation, and here I think that it's a mandatory bet just with some of the easier folds that villain will be able to make. I also think that if he has a hand like fours with the four clubs or something like that, he might even find a fold even though he made his flush or something. Yeah. And even sometimes it sounds crazy, but I do think that some small percentage of the time he can fold even one of the higher clubs.
It wouldn't be the craziest thing I've ever said. Guaranteed. If he folded face up, guaranteed.
Yeah, because he's that good. Yeah.
I was playing with this guy the other night who was showing the most obvious bluffs in the world. It was like, you know, he would like raise pre-flop and bet the flop and then like turn his cards over and be like, yeah, I bluffed you. It was awesome.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's very good. Boy, I'd love to be able to give results, but Gareth in true non-results-oriented form didn't include results, so... So thanks for the hand, Gareth. Thanks for everybody who's writing in. We have a queue of very nice hands that we'll talk about in the upcoming weeks. You should also email us with hands or questions or comments or rants or criticisms or anything else you want to email to the show, podcast@thinkingpoker.net.
We have exciting iTunes news also.
Oh, yes, we do have exciting iTunes news.
So, and I apologize that this has taken so long, because a number of people have contacted me to ask about this. For a while, there were only the 5 most recent episodes of the show were available on iTunes. I've got that straightened out now, so if you subscribe on iTunes, or if you would like to be subscribed on iTunes, but were frustrated that you couldn't get back episodes, every episode of the show is now available through iTunes. Strongly encouraged, if you are listening on there or if you would like to be listening on there, go on there, rate and review the show. We've had some very nice reviews, and we're currently sitting on 5 stars, which is awesome. So we'd love to have some more of that kind of feedback on iTunes. And the old episodes of the show are also available from the podcast tab of the thinkingpoker.net website. So if you'd rather get your old episodes that way, just click on where it says podcast when you get to the main page of thinkingpoker.net, and you can find all the old episodes are there.
21 episodes, all free, something like 40 hours of free entertainment. So if you've got a really long road coming up or something like that, you know, load up and let them rip. So now I think we should play the interview with Andrew's grandmother.
Well, actually, before we do, I want to take a minute just to give you a little bit of an introduction. I think because she's talking to me, my grandmother just kind of dives right into these stories as though you already know who Tubby is. And I think it'll be helpful if I give you a little bit of context. So his real name was Charles Booth, although I always knew him as Uncle Tubby. And his stage name was Tubby Boots, and it essentially became his real name. I don't know of anyone who actually called him Charles. Everyone just called him Tubby or something like that. He was born in the 1930s, and he enjoyed a career that lasted from his teenage years all the way up until his death in 1993. He was most famous in Miami Beach, but he also played on cruise ships in Las Vegas, in California, in New York, and in the beach resort of Ocean City, Maryland.
his show was a body vaudeville-esque mix of stand-up comedy, song and dance, and drag. I was only 10 years old when he died, so I never got to see him perform. I think it would have been inappropriate to bring a child there, not that my father didn't see him when he was a child. But but I have heard some recordings of Tubby, and I've seen bits of his show on YouTube. I'm actually going to link a few of those YouTube clips in the show notes, and I encourage you to check them out before you listen to this interview. So I think it's going to help a lot for you to see Tubby, see what he looks like and see how he performs to fully appreciate him. His physicality was really central to his act. He weighed nearly 400 pounds. He dressed garishly. He had all these over-the-top characters that he did on stage, a nun, an opera singer, an aging stripper. And honestly, I think even the YouTube clips are going to be a pretty poor substitute, because I'm sure that seeing him live and being in his presence would be an entirely different experience. He really was a larger-than-life personality. And although a lot of his humor would not be considered politically correct today, in fact, it was probably pretty politically incorrect in his time as well, he really was a great lover of people. And as far as I know, he got along with everyone, and he had a really diverse network of fans and friends. He was an eccentric person, and he attracted a lot of eccentric people to him. My grandmother's fond of saying, it was never a dull moment with Tubby. She was his older sister by a couple of years. They grew up in South Baltimore. Basically, it's the neighborhood that was highlighted in season 2 of The Wire. And in fact, my grandfather was a longshoreman, like a lot of the characters. And my grandmother took on a lot of responsibility from a young age. As far as I know, her father was not around that much, and my grandmother started working when she was 14 years old. She got married when she was 17. She moved in with my grandfather and his mother, who was blind. His father was dead. And she took on a lot of responsibility in that household, in addition to continuing to look after Tubby, her other younger brothers, and their mother. And then a few years later, my grandfather joined the Marines. He went to fight in Korea, and my grandmother was left home with all of that and was also pregnant with their first child at the time. So she had a lot on her plate already, and then, as you'll find out, Tubby was bringing a rotating cast of freaks, and I mean that literally, like some of them were actually carnival freaks, by the house as well. But Tubby did end up repaying that kindness throughout his life. He made a lot of money, but between his generosity and his love of gambling, he never really held on to too much of it. Whenever he did have money, he bought lavish gifts for people. He took his sister and her family on vacations all across the U.S. and Europe. Grandma's going to tell you more about their adventures together. Those are some of her favorite stories. So the last thing that I want to tell you by way of orientation is that my grandmother will often refer to my grandfather as your father. I think this is just because she's so used to telling these stories to her children, and once she gets into that storytelling mode, she forgets who she's talking to. I don't know. It's just something that she does. So when you hear her talk about your father, the old man, pops, dad, she's actually talking about my grandfather most of the time. Hopefully it'll be clear from context. So now that I've got you a little oriented, this is my grandmother talking about a great performer, a great gambler, and my great uncle, Tubby Boots.
Welcome. Before we start, how many of you nice people have never seen me perform live at a nightclub? Have you seen? Raise the hand. Never. Oh, we have a few virgins here, eh? Well, first of all, so that we don't get too shocked, I feel this way. No matter what I say, no matter what I do, you came to see me. I did not go looking for you. This is not a sewer. You don't fall in here accidentally. You must come to Gunning's to search me out. My sister Sylvia is married to a Polish boy from South Baltimore, Leonard Prokowski, 1518 Covington Street, right behind Lucky's Market, you know, Ford Avenue. And nice boy, you know what I mean? Not too bright, but nice, you know. We were out driving the other day. I said, Leonard, do me a favor. Look out the window. Let me know if my turn signal's working. He said, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. I said, thank you, Leonard. Very good, very good. I learned what I wanted to learn, you know. Yeah, I'm in a good mood tonight, too. All the pretty waitresses there. Donna, when you get a chance, bring me a glass of ice water, would you please? I'm up here under the bright lights tonight. Showbiz is my life.
So how would you introduce Tubby to somebody who had never met him before? What was the first thing you would tell them about him?
Be careful. No. He's funny in his way. He likes people, and he's real forward. I mean, there's nothing shy about him at all. He wasn't afraid to try anything. Probably that wasn't the best thing to do. But he always was sensitive. He loved little kids. And anybody that was down on their luck, he always kind of felt sorry for him. Like my mother, he took everybody under his wing, and he helped a lot of people. And he would get in these predicaments. Like I said, we'd go to the racetrack, and you'd have to catch a tram to get over there. And there was a couple of racetracks down there, Tropical and Calder Racetrack.
Dogs or horses?
These were horses. And they had the dog tracks, too, you know. But we went to all, any kind. If it moved, we went, you know. And on the way down, when your dad would ride him down, if they came down together, they'd have to stop at a track on the way down in Daytona. They had been to the tracks here, anywhere where there was a track, he knew. But he just was a character. It's like almost like one of the Damon Runyon characters that you heard about in New York at the time. It used to be Guys and Dolls was a run on that show because of this character. And we had a guy in Baltimore, too, named Mr. Diz, who was a racehorse fan, and they always used to put him on the racetrack news and everything. And, of course, Tubby knew all these people. And coming down here, a lot of the announcers from Baltimore, Ann Bishop, I remember, she was a woman. She came down here and became quite a commentator in Miami. Another guy, there was a guy named Clem. We used to run into him a lot, but he was into boxing. But Tubby got to know all these sports figures because of all the Italian big-time friends that he had, who I'm sure were not as straight and narrow as they could have been, but they always treated us fine. I could never say anything, you know.
You went to a wedding, didn't you?
Not only went to a wedding, I never changed clothes so much in my life in toilets all over the East Coast. I got picked up at Green Airport up in Rhode Island, and the wedding was in Springfield, and that's how you got to Springfield, was through this thing. And a guy met me, and it was pouring down rain. Come out to the plane, pick me up with an umbrella, takes me down, and we get into the airport, and we have to change clothes. So he puts me in the men's room, and he stands outside, and he said, "Now you can change there, and I'll watch for you." So I did that. Just put on nice street clothes to go to church in. Okay. So we get to the church, and I'll never forget it. I'm sitting outside, and it's beautiful. Big church. And I said to Tubby, "Well, what do I do about the stuff in the car? You know, what I'm leaving in the car, I can't take it all in there." He said, "Well, all the crooks are inside. Ain't nobody going to take anything." So while I'm up there, we go to the reception. Well, now I got to change again. And this was a beautiful place. It was called Shea Joseph's. And they had a black doorman with a high hat and long runner. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. And this is the first time I ever flew by myself up there, right? And Tubby doesn't give me any credit at all. He figures, you know, I got there. That was one thing. All right. So we're in there, and I go in and went to the ladies' room again, and I changed into a long dress, you know. So they had all these at the Italian weddings. They would tap on the glasses for the people.
To the tests.
Uh-huh. Well, there was plenty big-time guys sitting there, and they made plenty of money that time. But I think Tubby's agent, I guess he's dead now. I hope I'm not giving anything away. His brother was one of the big guys, you know. And, of course, afterwards, I stayed up there for a little while, and I went to his agent's house. Well, we had a good time, and I was having such a wonderful time. I was supposed to come home. I had my ticket already. But Tubby calls your grandfather and says, "She's having a good time. We're going to move her plane back. You know, we'll get her in later." Well, as it turned out, I had to get one that stopped over, you know, would stop in Philadelphia and then to Baltimore. So I get in the plane, but on my way to the airport now, I'm going to the airport. And I've got five of these, as I would call them, wise guys. They're with me, and Tubby says, big sign in Boston, this is, no parking. We parked there. We went in. "You want some magazines, hon?" I said, I really don't care. So I get all this stuff together, and then one guy gives me a piece of paper, and he says, "If you change planes and you don't catch the other one on time, this is a note. call this number and they'll come and take care of you. And when you went to see these people up north, he loved to eat. He could eat his way from Florida north, and every person's house he stayed in was the best meal he ever had. Somebody made the best pickles. Somebody made this. In Chicago, the Johnsons, they made the best Polish food. You know, and up there, I must have ate 4 Italian dinners from different people's homes all in about a 3-hour period, and I couldn't eat another piece of Italian food. He kept saying, you got to be nice. I said, I don't care. I can't eat like you. You know, it was unbelievable. But all of them, I don't care who it was. And then the one guy's name, he used to say, the judge this and the judge that. And I said, I would say, Your Honor. Come to find out, it was because he had been in front of a judge so many times. That's how he got the name. Or Pete the Chicken Killer. Oh, God. We had so many adventures. But I did see a godfather one time. I went down with Tubby's agent. We actually had gone to a prison for bail. He was also a bail bondsman. He had a seal inside.
You mentioned that a bail bondsman.
Well, he did. I mean, he was shrewd. He was smart. But Billy was nice. I liked Billy and Tina. They were lovely. Good people. And I said, what's she in for? It's a young Puerto Rican girl. Very pretty girl. He said, murder. I said, murder? And, you know, Uncle Tubby never got out during the daytime. He didn't know what it was to breathe fresh, clean air because he was always in a club or sleeping during the day. So I remember one time Billy and Tina take us on a trip up to Granby, Mass, where they make drums and things, it was called. And we're up on this mountain, Tom's Mountain, I think it was. And we got a picnic on top of the hood of the car, apples and all. Tubby says, God, it smells good up here. Billy says, that's because you never come outside of a club. You're around smoking and all that stuff all the time. And Tubby wasn't a smoker, and he really didn't like booze that much. Once in a while, he might get looped, and he hated to work New Year's Eve because people didn't pay attention. They got sloppy, that kind of stuff. But he just was the way he was, but the people, those people loved him. The Italian, and Coffee, Mr. Coffee up in Rhode Island owned a club, the Lincoln Lounge. I mean, I have met some people, and when I went up there, I saw more going on in the cloakroom than I ever did outside. I met Willie Pep, the fighter. I mean, I said to Tubby, you don't know, how do you meet all these people, you know? It was always a lot of fun with him, you know, but things always happened. I mean, they never went exactly according to Hall.
See, it's a known fact. All fat men have small peepees. Did you know that? It's because your peepee is connected to your belly button. Did you know that? In other words, if I lose weight, I will be hung like a horse. Meanwhile, if I gain weight, I'll have a pussy by next Friday. It's not a pucker now, you know. You can bet this shit ain't going on television. See, they spurs in and spurs out. You know what I mean? This is part of the stuff that you will see edited.
How would you describe his act?
Sometimes raunchy, but funny. He was.
It was kind of like vaudeville, too, right?
A lot of vaudeville in it. He could dance. He was light on his feet. And we used to play as kids. We'd put on shows for my mother. She said, I don't have to go to the movies. She says, you too. And I remember it was a song, I'm Glad I Found You. And he'd get behind me with his straw hat and hug me. And we'd do this for him, you know. And I always danced with one foot in church. I mean, I had the lessons, but I wasn't much of a tap dancer. But we would sing and dance for my mother, you know. But, and when he first went in show business, he used to take all these raggedy-looking kids from the neighborhood, and they'd go up the Hippodrome where they had stage shows. And the guys would ask for volunteers from the audience. Tubby would get up with these rowdy-looking kids all the time. And he met the Vagabonds up there. It was a group of guys. And they took a shine to him. And he started, he'd run away from home.
He's how old at that time?
I'd hate to say it, but about 13 or 14, you know. And I'd bring his behind home again, you know. And then he got out. But this guy in Vegas, I mean, when we went out there, it was always, I don't think we ever paid for a show. We got in. He got us in. It wasn't our idea, you know, but he got us in. Like Tom.
What era is that?
God, a decade. I don't even know. I'm trying to think now. When I went to Vegas the first time with him, all I seen was tumbleweed and maybe two or three little. I went in the airport and I saw the slots machines in the airport, but I wasn't impressed. I mean, I got when I come outside and I looked out. Here was like tumbleweed rolling down the street, and I looked out, and it's not green when you first see it, you know. And I thought, what's all the hullabaloo about this out here, you know? And it so happened, I'm trying to think, it was the first casino that the mafia got into. This was the first casino that we went to. And it so happened that Pepper Martin, but I knew him as Pepper Asner because I went to dancing school with him at DeMott's Studio of Dance on North Avenue in Baltimore. I mean, I go back a lot. And I told him this, and he laughed. He said, I don't remember you. I said, I wasn't such a hot dancer. I said, but I remember you, you know. And one of the girls in our class, too, she went on to become a rockette, you know. But then, I don't know, but lots of times your grandfather was working, and he couldn't get off. But when he could get off, and I was working, he would always go with your uncle, maybe go out to California on a cruise out that way, you know. And nothing, I mean, Uncle Tubby had no shame whatsoever.
Living legend, 400 pounds of sex-rated comedy, Mr. Tubby Boots.
I don't know how people get this impression of me, because if you're not getting more than me, you're not getting any. I don't want to tell you how bad my luck is, but this afternoon I had a date with a hunchback girl. I had the hole dug in the sand. She never showed up. I could show up at a woman's prison with a handful of pardons. I couldn't get laid. I mean that. M&Ms melt in my hand. But it's a sin to be a fat narcissist. Don't laugh, lady. A narcissist, that's one that looks in the mirror all the time. And until I can see it without looking in the mirror, I'll keep on looking in the mirror. You laugh. I'm built like a moose and hung like a mouse. I know what I've got. I walk around the house all day with a Pepsi Cola, pouring it on my schmuck, yelling, come alive! We're in the Pepsi generation!
And he got, to use a word, Molly screwed a lot. He helped people on the way up, and I don't think they ever give him the true worth for it. You know what I mean? Is
they didn't remember him when they
that
to
they
the
remember
top.
Him yeah. for? Yeah, uh-huh. And like they always say, watch out when you go up, because when you come down, you pass the same people. You know, but and he enjoyed life. God, he did enjoy life. He never missed a thing. He'd try anything, and a real good hustler. I mean, come hell or high water, he'd find a way. And he used to go out and shine shoes, you know, when he was a kid, he'd shine shoes. And then when he'd go away, he'd meet up with these different agents and people that set him up to play clubs. And then lots of times they didn't want to pay him, you know, and he would wind up with no money and have to call home. And we didn't have a phone. He would always call the lady across the street, and he'd say, send me money, you know. And particularly when I was pregnant with Sylvia, and I said to him, you know, I don't have a lot of money to send you. So instead of coming home by himself, he'd come home with the banjo player, who was supposed to only stay a couple weeks.
How did he meet this banjo player?
He played in clubs too, but I don't know, he could play like Eddie Peabody. I mean, he was really a good banjo player, but he didn't kind of have the looks or the personality to go with it, yeah. You know. Nice man, and he would go out busting just like Tubby liked to get money, like for Christmas when we didn't have much money and Dad was overseas in the Marine Corps. And Sylvia was just born, you know. And they would go out to the different bars around town. And what they call busting, they would he'd play the banjo and, you know. And when
just
Tubby
to get
was,
people to put $1 and a half.
Yeah, that's all. And he always gave us the money, you know. I mean, he was generous, too. But you never knew. My mother always felt like when he come home, the king had arrived. You know, it might be 4 o'clock in the morning, but my mother would be there cooking fried chicken and all, and making sure that he had something to eat. And then he'd come in with 3 or 4 people, but you always get it back because the same people, her name was Tirza, I don't remember the boy's name, the son's name, but they were Carney people. I met them then on the way down to wherever they were heading, probably down to Florida. And consequently, the first time we went down to Florida, Tubby took us out on a cruise to Bimini Island. Well, when we got down there to go onto the cruise ship, come to find out, Bobby was the boy's name. Tirza was his mother. Bobby was working in the ticket office. Tubby and I had a royal suite on top of on top of the ship. And the two boys, Al and Len, they went in the forecastle, like the sailors. They went down there. And actually, we got to Bimini, and I'm thinking, oh, this is really going to be some beautiful place. Well, where we docked looked like a dirt alley. And they had these little concession stands with the natives and all. Oh, but hot and bugs and oh, I couldn't wait to get back on the boat to go back to the mainland. But anyway, he had told me how beautiful it was. Sure, it was beautiful on the other side of the island. That's where the bigwigs stayed and all the mansions, you know. So we weathered through that and coming back, the boat got stuck on a sandbar, and he had to be back to work that night, I think at the Place Pigalle he was working then. And so we had to go in by tender. Now, you see this big hulk of a guy who weighs at least 350 pounds at that time, getting down into the boat, pushing him in, you know, and all. We had to call ship to shore to make sure that they knew he was coming, and it was just an adventure. And then he always, him and Billy with water. The worst luck was water.
Billy was his manager?
Huh?
Billy was his
manager? No, Billy was just one of those people that he brought home from, actually he was in the Kearney too at one time. But he brought him down home, and Billy stayed for a long time, you know. But he was a very nice young man, and they just, like, moved in with my mother. And my mother had, like, a regular hotel. This is before Pop come home. But later on, like, Billy worked with him down in Florida, too. And he used to make costumes and things for the shows and everything. One time, Tubby went on this cruise for nothing, because if he went, all he had to do was sing a song or something or entertain a little bit, and he could go on the cruise. And they don't usually put you on the roster, you know, when you're telling you that you're going to be on the cruise. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was Good Friday. I'll never forget it. And it came on the news that this plane, the ship, had caught fire out in the water. And it happened to be the boat he was on, because I figured he was on there, but they didn't have any listing for him. And me and my aunt, we went through everything. And all I could say was, he always used to say, if I go overboard, the people can float home on me. Because I said, and I'm looking out at the water, and I'm thinking, if I see a big whale, it'll be nice, you know. But when he finally got in, they took him into Guantanamo Bay. Now, he lost his luggage. He lost all the money that he made, everything. It was down. So he calls us. When he answered the phone, when I picked it up, I couldn't talk. I was so excited that he was okay. Yeah. And your grandfather was upstairs. And when he heard me stand there stuttering, he said, tell him it's all right. Tell him, ask him where he is, what he needs. And so we told him, you know, he told us. And finally, he had this friend that lived in South Beach, and her name was Moy Lee. She loved him. She really loved him. She meets the ship when it comes in. And, of course, being an actor, he had to be the first one off the ship because he got all the...
He's a star.
Yeah, because he's a star and he got all the publicity. And here's Moy Lee with a couple little packages of food. Don't worry, fat boy. You don't have to worry. You got something to eat. Moy Lee, look out for you. Oh, God. That was one time. I mean, one time he's in a boat with Billy. Small, like a rowboat. And for some reason they got stuck. They must have been on the sandbar, I don't know. And they don't want to jump out because they're afraid everything, the water's deep. And when he went over, the water was up to his knees. I mean, you had to hear him tell these things. I mean, it was always something that went haywire. But he'd always say, it's part of our adventure. And things always turn out right.
You know, I picked up, this is a true story. I got in a cab today with a woman cab driver. I said, take me to the cheapest whorehouse in Florida. She said, you're in it. I said, ain't a goy, I'm laughing. Right away, I said something funny. They think that's dirty. A schmuck, that's a guy that gets out of the shower to take a leak. You know, you talk about, this is the truth, girls. Listen to me when I tell you. I'm the only guy I know can look at dirty movies and get a hard in. People don't seem to understand that I don't want this reputation of being a sex fiend. I had a woman said to me the other night, you're a pervert. You go to bed with anything, a cat, a dog, a worm, a chicken. I said, a chicken? Never. You gotta have a little class. That's like the woman, she's walking down the street with one of her breasts hanging out. Cop said, lady, that's indecent. She said, my God, I left the baby on the bus.
Like, when we used to stay at the Dunes with him when he was a headliner down there and ran the show, he always got us a big suite of rooms. And we had carte blanche. I mean, the big hotel owners were very wonderful to us. That was in his contract that his family could come down and stay.
So he ran away when he was 13. He met up with...
Yeah, he just went around and... maybe he was a little bit older. Maybe about 15. Because he did female impersonations up in the worst section of the city. And then they had a couple gay clubs up there. And he would make his own costumes. And he would sing, let me entertain you. And he'd do all these arrangements and stuff. But he always liked... I'm just the opposite. He had every gadget known to man. If he knew all this now, he'd have it. Every time something new come out, he'd have it. It's just how he was. He just liked all that kind of stuff. Show business, like I said, he did it on his own. I think he went out. Wesley met this guy, and I'm trying to think of his name because when he died, Tubby was really upset, you know. But his daughter and all, whenever Tubby would go out to Vegas, they'd pop in, and Tubby knew a couple of agents that you meet, and he was on the radio a couple of times out in Hollywood and Vegas talking. I think I have a tape of him somewhere with that, you know. But the tapes that he made at the shows, I gave one of them to. I still have a couple. But your father made him, transferred him to disc, and I said
to
him,
gave me one of those.
Did he? I said, I still have a couple of them. He said, well, give them to me. They may be repeats. But I don't think your father has any of the old records that he had. Because, I have to tell you, I was an owner of a record company. The Silland Records. I never got a dime. Never got a sou. And he'd say, I'm paying for the kids' education. Every cent I make from these tapes go to my nieces and nephews. Biggest liar.
He told people he was Jewish too, right?
Oh, yeah. Especially, he'd sing Yiddish Mama, knew that all the way through. And Italians, knew every Italian song there was. And, you know, and when he got stuck someplace, like I said, where they didn't want to pay him, it upset me. And at the end, I think his feelings got very hurt. There was a commentator, or one of the girls on television now in Baltimore. I can't think of her name. She's a pretty girl. She's got a round face. She followed him when he was down Ocean City, and she followed him on the boardwalk and talked to him and everything and all. But there was a guy, and I can't think of his name. He used to work for the News Post, and then they shut down. And he was a commentator for a while, but he would do interviews. And he interviewed Tubby, and he made him sound like an old has-been. And Tubby said that wasn't the impression that he was given, that he was just going to do a and I think it... Not the... As it was, things had closed down a lot for these type of acts and all. Yeah. And he was going around with the Marvelettes and different song groups and going doing police shows all across the country. And I mean, it was people like to see them all. You know, you see a lot of it on public television. You'll see these guys come on and sing and everything. But he was making a living, you know. But it wasn't like in the heyday, and he never saved any money. Hell, the people that worked for him could buy and sell him. I mean, it was two gay guys. I never even knew they were gay. Your grandfather never did either. He just never thought of that because they didn't look it, they didn't act it or nothing. You couldn't see anything. And they bought a hotel, you know, and they worked every night with him, you know. But like I said, I can't say he didn't enjoy life. He did.
You know where I get these things from, don't you? People stop me. I meet people in the oddest places. You know, I meet the weirdest people in the toilet. The other night, I'm standing in the toilet. Some guy comes running in. He pulls out this great big thing. He said, "I just made it." I said, "Would you make me one of them?" Wow! Some of the things that happened to me, you wouldn't... I gotta tell you, a friend of mine is an undertaker, an embalmer, and an undertaker pal. And he's embalming this body, and he noticed the guy's got a cork in his ass. He pulls out the cork, he hears, "Winchester Cathedral!" He shoves the cork back in, he says, "I must be going out of my mind." He pulls the cork out again, he hears, "Winchester Cathedral of Odeodo." He shoves the cork back in. He calls up his friend. He says, "Charlie, get over here right away." He said, "What seems to be the trouble?" He said, "Don't ask me over the phone. You'll think I'm crazy. Get over here." 20 minutes later, Charlie comes bursting in. He said, "What's the trouble?" He pulls out the cork. He said, "Listen to this. Winchester Cathedral." He said, "You got me out of bed at 4:30 in the morning to listen to some asshole sing Winchester Cathedral?"
Wasn't Tubby married as part of like a green?
Oh God, yes. What the hell was her first name? Oh, your father thought she was the best. He was only young. He was like 13, mm-hmm. And she wore them short skirts. But she was built. She was built, and you never saw a thing. She sat down, legs were perfectly gorgeous. She used to be, I think, a mistress before Tubby married her. I don't think they were in love. I think he just did her a favor.
Like one of the mob mistresses, you mean?
Huh?
Like one of the mob mistresses, you mean? Or?
No, she belonged to... Was it Seagram 7 Canadian? What's Canadian?
Canadian whiskey or gin.
Yeah, the owner of that. She was involved with him. Okay. Kim, her name was. And I remember one of the reporters from the Miami Herald. We knew them, too. He wanted to date her. So I said, "Go ahead, you can take her out." Yeah. But she was always a lady in front of everybody. But your father, I think he was just fascinated because she was different. And I mean, he's a young kid.
He was 13 and she was wearing a short skirt.
She wasn't, I don't think she was all that pretty. She wasn't a bad looking girl, but she wouldn't have been my idea. I mean, body-wise, yeah. Same way with that goofy one. Who was it? What the hell was her name? She had been a stripper. I went up to 2 o'clock club one night to take her money, and the guy offered me a job. I said, "You're out of your happy mind." Me and Babs. He said, "Let me see your legs." I said, "Why?" Babs said, "You know such interesting people." I said, "I don't know this man. I come up here to deliver." What did she want? She was living with us, and she wore a hobble skirt. This is hysterical. She was built, too. She had this tight skirt on. Walk like this. Dad said she's going to fall flat on her face. But she wanted to make me up with eyes and all this. She did it one night, and I went bowling. Christ, I couldn't see it bowling. I was bowling terrible. And the guy said, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "Never was real good at it." I said, "But I can't see good." But when I went up there, I used to stop in just to give her stuff or something. Tubby would send something up. And that's how I met Billy. Billy and her come home. And I thought, when he brought them in, I went out the back door. My Aunt Libby said to me, she was at the house, she said, "Sil, promise me you won't kill him right now. Wait until these people leave." I said, "Just my luck, they won't leave." I said, "I refuse. I'm not doing this."
So he had a stripper living with you for a while?
Oh, yeah. Always had stray strippers. Never knew what was coming. Billy, she did a cute act. She wasn't that vulgar, you know. But I would go up there, and one of my old boyfriends happened to be. He went to the track. He knew your father real well. He was the first boy I ever went with. Ernest Linwood Sawyer. I used to call him Blockhead. I could say that. But he took me to my first Preakness when I was young. I mean, yeah. And he sang like an angel. Him and two other rotten kids sang in the boys' choir, and I was the announcer. But them three Army boys had the most beautiful voices when they sang holy songs. I mean, it was amazing, you know. His first word ever told me about gay people. I didn't believe him. That's how young I was. He took me to the movies. We were in the balcony of the Century Theater downtown near where Aunt Camilla used to live, downtown across from the gas company. And there was two guys over on the side. He was in the Navy at the time, this boy. He said to me, "I don't want you looking over there." I said, "I ain't looking nowhere." He said, and he's telling me, I said, "You're crazy." He said, "No, I'm not." I always knew something was a little wrong with Tubby, but I didn't want to believe it. I wouldn't let nobody say nothing about him. In fact, I found out right before we went on my 25th wedding anniversary, and I got so upset. I said to Leonard, "I'm not going." Your uncle, your grandfather. He said, "What do you mean you're not going?" He said, "How different is he from yesterday? You loved him yesterday. What the hell's wrong with you today?" Yeah. You know. And I said, "I don't like that guy." Some guy said, he always kept that apart. If I came, whoever he had at the house, whoever was his partner at the time. Mm-hmm. Although the one boy I met up in Boston, or Springfield, he had been married and had a couple kids. But the wife knew it, and she still loved him. Mm-hmm. And when he died right before my father, or right after my father, the same month in April of that same year. And he never fooled with this young boy. Was his ideal. I mean, he was a good-looking young guy. He was Italian. And his youngest son, I mean, Tubby used to give the kids all kind of stuff and all. He was always helping her out and everything. But it was just such a I knew it, but I didn't want to believe it. Yeah. You know how you are, and I didn't want to believe it. And it really bothered me, you know.
How did he tell you?
He didn't tell me.
How did you find out?
Well, I seen the guy and, you know, and everything. And then I put, and I said to Leonard, "Oh, I don't understand this." He said, "Yes, you do." You know, he was my anchor for that. I mean, he could keep me calm because he'd always say to me, "Promise me. Look at me in the eye, Sylvia, and promise me you're not going to fight with him. You promise me?" I said, "I promise." He said, "I know you're lying." He said, "Because the minute he walks in the door," and I did say to him, "I can't help it. He gets to me sometimes, and I could kill him." And then the last time, I still don't feel right about it, but the day they took him out of the house when he was real sick, he wanted to go up to University of Maryland, and they wanted to take him to South Baltimore, and I had to get a private ambulance because they would take him to the nearest hospital. And somebody, he said, "I'll put your husband in the car." And I just was mad about something, and I said, "He's not my husband. He's my brother." And I never, when I went to the hospital to see him, he was in intensive care, and they were trying to put a stent in, and they had him downstairs when Sylvie and I went in the afternoon. And the nurse said to me, "Come back this evening and you can get in." So Syl and I went home. We come back up at about 6 o'clock at night. We were standing outside, and I said to him, "I just want to go in and see him. I just want to tell him I was sorry. I was so mean, you know." And I could hear the doctors talking to him. He was talking like, "I'm here." And the room they had him in was like on the other side of that sofa, and it was a door there, and I could hear everything going on. And when I went in, he said to me, I think you better wait till tomorrow morning. Now, I've been standing there over an hour and a half, and I said, are you sure? And he said, yeah. And it wasn't, I'm sorry, it wasn't your grandfather. It was Sylvia, because your grandfather was home. So I went home, and I went upstairs, and I bet I wasn't home. I think I left the hospital around 11:30, something like that. And I get a call. And I said to the girl, how is he? And I hear code blue, code blue. And I said, oh my God. And she said to me, Sylvia, he's gone. And I said, what? I ran upstairs and I tapped your father because he had gone to bed. And he sat up and he said, I'll put clothes on, we'll go right up. So we went up and he was laying there and he had that pipe in his mouth. Looked like my mother laying there with them big blue eyes, you know, just, and I just couldn't believe it. That was really upsetting to me. But I've often thought about it. But he'll know. He used to say to me, I'm leaving everything I got to you. I said, don't leave me your debts. I don't want them. I do not want them. Assie and Sylvia, we wrote blank letters, and I had to sign and tell these people that they weren't getting paid. Oh, God, so many. But when he died, I got calls from all over. It's amazing how many people. And when we had the memorial service down in Florida, we had the regular funeral up here, and some people had come up. But then we went down there, they had a piano and they had a big picture of him behind, and some guy was playing like the songs that he sang. And from all the people that worked on the ships, the waiters and everything, to the guys that owned, and I hadn't seen the one man in years and years, and he come over to me and he said, you don't know who I am? I said, yes, I do, you know, because I had been to his home. He had a beautiful home. But he loved Tubby, you know, and had so many people there, you know. I bet it was 400 people in that room there. And I mean, they're all coming over talking to me. And I had tapes and I gave some to different ones, you know. But like I said, Sylvia spent all that money. She got him a great big floral arrangement that said, out of this world, because he used to have a record that said out of this world. And she had this flowers made with shooting stars, and it was really pretty. It was about $300 for the thing. Yeah. Well, back then,
he would have wanted that, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know how I put him in a casket? I put him in his tuxedo with his red bow tie, a cane, and his straw hat, deck of cards, some money, you know, in there, because when he got up there, Aunt Lizzie's good waiting for you. She's going to be playing cards, you know. And his red tassels that he used to use when he did his comedy strip. I put him in there with him, and off he went.
What good is soap alone in your room? Come hear that music play. My life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting while the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Why, life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine. Hit a band. Blow your horn. Start celebrating. Shake it down. Your table's waiting. Stop by admitting. From cradle to tomb. Isn't that far away? Believe me, life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Just taste the wine. Hit a band. Your horn, start celebrating, smoke a joint, your table's waiting, stop by admitting, from cradle to tomb, isn't that long a stay, believe me, life is a cabaret, old chum, this statue is gonna get me some, and I love